Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 174, Principles of the Path, Both On and Off the Mat.
So therefore, these are, you know, Buddhism, people think it's an ism, it's a religion, but, and it is a religion for people who don't practice it. If you don't practice it, and you just believe that people who do are doing a good thing, and you just sort of, you're devoted to them, or you like them, then it becomes a religion. And so it is to them. But if you practice it, which was mostly the monks and nuns in the ancient time, a few lay people, but mostly monks and nuns because of the low level of literacy in the ancient agricultural culture, then you realize it is an education system rather than a religion. In other words, it's really against beliefs. It's critiquing. Actually, one of the six addictions is conviction. It's called the view, the rigid view. It doesn't say wrong view, actually. It just says any view held in a religion way, a rigid way, where you're sort of, your life is your view, rather than itself, your life. You know? And so it's an education of opening your mind, and not closing it around a belief system, like we define in modern times, religion is defined. So therefore, I'm just saying that preliminarily to this, reading these three principles of that. And in talking about Tantra, which mainly we do in comparison with Hatha Yoga tradition, which is really tantric, although it reports to be non-tantric, but it is really tantric, chakras and all of that, that means. But these are the necessary educations that are involved, that this is a very short form of, okay? So I will explain as best I can the key import of all the Victor's teachings, the Buddha's teaching. You know, Buddha is called Victor Jinnah, because it's a culture in his time which was militarized. He was in the warrior class. But he's the one who most strongly, Mahavira of the Jains also, and also some of the Upanishadic great teachers, but they changed the important victory as being a victory over yourself rather than victory and conquest over others. But they call them Jinnahs anyway, victors. Path praised by all the holy bodhisattvas. Okay, so bodhisattva, then you know, bodhisattva, sattva means a being, or it can also mean the light energy, you know, in the three gunas of the sankhya. But sattva means a being, and also it can mean a hero or a warrior. So a bodhisattva is, the Tibetans translated as a jangchub senpa. So they had the idea of a hero, spiritual hero, they translate sattva. And bodhi means enlightenment. So that means a hero for enlightenment or a heroine for enlightenment, one who has made that their battle, their war against their own inner addictions and delusions and so forth, to become enlightened. Because that's a bodhisattva. And it doesn't mean necessarily a high being. A beginner bodhisattva can be very unaccomplished, but it just means one who has that orientation. Best entry for those destined to seek freedom. So listen with clear minds, you lucky people, who aspire to the path that pleases Buddhas, and strive to make meaning of liberty and opportunity, not being addicted to the pleasures of cyclic living. So to make a meaning of your liberty and opportunity now, this is really two very key concepts, which is what human life is described, a certain type of human life, the type of human life that you have, that we have, is described as the precious jewel of a human embodiment, endowed with liberty and opportunity. And of course, not all human societies do endow people with liberty to use their lives to develop themselves, that means, or to free themselves from sufferings of different kinds. They don't necessarily allow that. You have to work for the society, you have to fit in, you have to, you know, do your duty, you know, serve in the army, serve in the maternity ward, serve in whatever the society considers productively essential to itself. And so they don't offer that. And then opportunity, of course, part of opportunity is defined as that which, you know, knowing that there is such a thing as freedom from suffering, which is not really obvious, actually. People don't necessarily believe there is such a thing. It takes a little bit of imagination to think of it. Of course, there's a relative freedom, temporarily alleviation or relief from this pain or that pain. And all religions and all actually sort of all global worldviews or overall worldviews do tell people that there's a way out, including secularism. Secularism pretends that it doesn't need to, but actually in doing so, it does. And, you know, in other words, religions say, no, you should expect to suffer in life, because that's the nature of life. But then in heaven, if you're good and you join the church or you join the mosque or you join the synagogue or you join the temple or you join whatever it is, religiously, then you'll be taken care of after you die. You'll go to heaven, you'll go to happy hunting ground, you'll go to the ancestors' heaven, whatever the version people have. So they do that, although they don't say you can be free of suffering in life, actually, except some temporary alleviation of some temporary pain. That's a unique Buddha thing, actually, initially, that you can be completely free of suffering in life. That's a really strange idea. It's not even credible. Do you think? Do you believe that if someone told you, oh, take this or do that and you'll never suffer, and yet you'll just have a life like you have, but you won't suffer at all? Do you think? Do you actually believe that? How do you believe that? We don't, necessarily. And therefore, when there's an opportunity involves where there has been some tradition or some teacher, and not all human societies are aware of this, that actually has discovered the way to such a freedom. And actually many people have decided that it's worth a try, and many people have ratified that announcement or that decision and have found such a freedom through history. But it still doesn't mean that other people won't believe it or won't try for it or et cetera, or discouraged about it. It doesn't mean that we won't have a society like America where major, major product, $1 billion thing is selling pills against depression. Barrels of them, giant barrels of antidepressants in this country, for example. Although we're supposed to be the happiest country. Right? Hungary? No?
Way down.
Well, that's in the recent science of happiness, yeah, which is good. Holland and Denmark tend to win, the Scandinavian countries. And about states in America, Colorado, California, Oregon, they're on the way with the desperate weird-art action happening from the Justice Department. Lust for existence chains all bodied beings. Cyclic living, by the way, yes, cyclic living doesn't just mean, cyclic living does mean Bill Murray's Groundhog Day. It's exactly what it means, but it doesn't mean it in that you just go and your clock resets and you get up again and then the groundhog is coming out like in Bill Murray's thing. He made it within this life of Bill Murray. But cyclic living means you'll be reliving another life after you die. And whatever you did wrong this life, whatever you didn't learn, whoever you harmed, whatever it is, they have to repeat dealing with that situation until you eventually do it. That's what cycle. You know, samsara, the word samsara, really just means the cycle. It does. The total flow, actually. It's the total flow where you're helplessly driven and repeating and repeating the same thing. And if you just are being driven and you have no self-independent will power about it, then you're completely flowing in the realm of suffering. So the cycle, samsara, is something they don't like the sound of in the Buddhist worldview. Okay, lust for existence chains all bodied beings. Addiction to cyclic pleasures is only cured by transcendent renunciation. So first of all, seek transcendence. So this is this word, ngerjoma. in Tibetan, and Nidhyana in Sanskrit, and it means like definitely going to escape from the cycle. And it has two forms, but although they're both similar in that there's a definite escape involved. And the one form is definite escape with the idea that nirvana is somewhere else. And, you know, connects, unfortunately, to the misunderstanding of Buddhism in countries that are newly introduced to it, of the Buddhist inner science, the misunderstanding that, yes, okay, there could be an immediate escape of suffering, we could completely be free of suffering in this life. But that would mean escaping from this body, escaping from this relative world to a transcendent world, to our transcendent realm called nirvana. Even though nirvana is carefully distinguished by Buddha as not being heaven, and it's carefully distinguished as not being one of the four formless or immaterial states, like, you know, trance states, that you can become a deity in for millions of years. It's not identified with the Brahma heavens and all the elaborate, the 23 different heavens that the layers of heaven that Buddhist cosmology divides. The after-death possibility, or the another kind of life. Life is a god. And yogis can reach those in meditation without leaving their human body also. But therefore, in a way, that kind of meditation in the Buddhist education system is considered a little bit dangerous, the super quietist meditation, because then you have the ability as a yogi or a yogini to go into planes of like Brahma godliness, or absolute space, you know, infinite space, absolute nothingness, a seeming place of nothingness. And although, of course, it isn't nothingness, it's a place that seems like nothingness. And you can have that ability just by developing serious and extreme transic concentration. And the danger from the Buddhist point of view, evolutionary point of view, is that then you think that's nirvana, and you get stuck there as a deity of it, and then you're back out after a long time, according to their view, many, many years. Thoreau touches on it. Some of you must have read Walden, the book by Thoreau. At the end, there's this thing about a guy who makes a walking stick for a friend that takes him aeons to make. By the time he makes it, then he doesn't know where his friend went. But there, he gets that from a certain Indian book at the time. Thoreau did, almost 100 years ago. And so it's like that when you go in a formless realm. Because when you're in a realm like that, a more or less unconscious realm, you have no sense of time. So a really long time can seem like a moment. Like when you sleep at night and then you have to wake up suddenly. But it is 8 or 9 hours later. Okay, so those are just preliminary. Now this again, liberty and opportunity are hard to get. And there is no time to life. Keep thinking on this, and you will turn off your obsession, maybe I should translate, with this life. So this is a very important foundational thing. Your special type of human embodiment that you all have, that we all have, is not that easy to get. Animals without language, of which there are zillions, they don't have this kind of liberty and opportunity. They just have to follow their evolutionary niche, and they have to hunt their food and subsistence and not be hunted for food by others. And, you know, domesticated or wild, it's a rough life. They have no such liberty and opportunity, and they're pretty much hardwired within their thing, but not completely. They also have choice. That's how they move from, in Buddhist biology, that's how beings move from one animal species to another, sort of mounting up into higher evolution. And the higher evolution is, human is high, gods are higher than humans, but an angel types, you know, things like that, some demons. But they are a little bit too high, so they feel invulnerable, so they don't use their life. It's not a good place for them to use their life to attain enlightenment, to attain real freedom, full freedom from suffering, because they're sort of too comfortable, and they're just too indulged, you know, and they won't really develop. Whereas humans have the same intelligence as that, but they and can therefore transform themselves, can consciously intervene in their evolutionary reactions and actions, and they have more ability to make choices to improve their evolutionary condition, their karmic condition. But they're vulnerable humans, and we know how much it can hurt, and we have, you know, our lifespan is not that long at this era, actually. Some humans can live much longer, they say in Buddhist cosmology. But anyway, so that makes our life form very, very ideal. And this, we don't really feel that, you know. If you're a secularist, oh yeah, no, I wanted to say, like, secularism also promises you freedom from suffering. You realize that. And people who like their secularism, you know, this world, I'm a materialist, I'm a scientific materialist. My grandfather was like that. They like that because they are promised freedom from suffering through annihilation. And of course, every upstanding person says, well, I don't crave nothingness. I don't crave annihilation. But that would be deceiving themselves. Everyone craves annihilation every night. If you've been up a long time and you're really tired, you want to be unconscious and you don't want to feel anything. You've got confident you're going to wake up again, of course. So you're not, it's not like you're dying. You don't call in all your relatives and say goodbye every night when you fall asleep. But you are happy to be unconscious and be not there, so to speak. And then people addicted to all these opioids and all this sort of thing, which is a worldwide thing, very widespread. They are seeking annihilation of their sensitivity. So the materialist is promising you, who think you only have this life, and that you will be free of suffering after death. So then, therefore, now continue to work in the factory or the internet company or whatever it is. And the university, the farm, the ranch, whatever you work in. And, you know, it's kind of unbearable, and it's tiresome, and, you know, it's endless, and whatever. Each layer of success then leads to another stress to achieve, and so on. But it's okay, and at least it's only one of them. It's only this one life you have to worry about, staying relatively comfortable. Whereas in the great majority of human beings on the planet, actually throughout history, have basically considered continuity to be the rule of thumb. You know, someone who would say that there's a radical discontinuity and sort of the burden of proof is on them. You know? The one who would say something can become nothing, right? Since no one's ever experienced something becoming nothing, right? Has anybody ever experienced that? Is nothing a scientific discovery by modern science? Have they discovered that there's a nothing waiting for, you know, a good upstanding real estate developer who lives on 57th Street in New York? Is there anybody who has discovered that, or a Texan, that they're going to not be there after they die? Who has discovered that? On what evidence is that assurance based? In other words, can anybody give any evidence? I know, there is one evidence. This one guy at Bellevue Hospital, I was there, I wasn't an inmate, actually. But I visited there once, and there was a high-level neuroscientist, one of those prize-type winning types, and he was desperate to get the dilemma. Brain in there and like see what it was like, and he got my brain in there and was disappointed. It seemed too coherent for him, he said, and he didn't get the Dalai Lama. But anyway, he's put electrodes on corpses and not detected any activity, so that's he considered the discovery of nothing in a corpse's brain. So that proved that at death the mind of the person was gone forever to him. But is that rational? Think about it. Nobody claimed that the mind of the dead person staying in the brain like doing, you know, sun exercises. You know, the mind has left the body, you know, so naturally there's nothing there. But that doesn't mean there's no mind there, no mental activity. Doesn't mean there is no mental activity somewhere else. That's not proven, you know. You can transmit over the internet some huge program or product, and it's no longer in your heart, and then delete it in your hard disk, but it's still somewhere else. So the rule of thumb in nature is that things have continuity. Your consciousness is kind of energy, right? And so all energy has continuity. So why is your consciousness the one energy that has no continuity, or is it no energy? Do you have a non-energy consciousness? Do you? Do you feel you do? We might. Actually, I was looking up, as I'm writing a book on Buddhist science, I was looking up. Do you realize that energy and matter, you know the difference? Energy has no mass. That's the technical thing. So the energy has no size. It doesn't have mass, energy. Okay? That's energy and matter. That's the different definition. So something with no mass can affect things with mass. That means, even for physicists, right? Secularist, scientific materialist physicists. So therefore, I know I'm going on about this, but it is really the most important thing you could possibly think about in your entire life. Because even if we think, I believe in reincarnation, I've been practicing the Dharma, I do yoga, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Buddhist, not necessarily, or even Christians, you know, everybody has some kind of rebirth. Even the secularists, they just have a really boring one, where they're just unconscious forever. But even we have some belief about it, we are programmed to only think about ourselves and identify with ourselves as what we are doing as in this body. We are just, and when this body stops, that's it. So we're only concerned with the extent of this body. So that means we are somewhat slightly psychotic, in the sense that we're somehow not present. We're present up to a certain point, then we're not present. And you might find in this the true source of inability to conquer global warming. It's not the Koch brothers, they're just one instance, you know. It's not the Robert Mercer, it's not the ridiculous government that we have at the moment. It's this attitude that whatever it is in the future, you know, the whole metaphor they always use about the boiling frog, right? Doesn't know it's boiling until it's too weak and too hot to get out. But, you know, we got that cured because we're the boiling frog and we won't be there. We'll be dead before it boils. So we don't care that much. We care. They say, all my grandchildren, you know, they all say it. But they don't really care about their grandchildren, obviously. Because everybody knows, including all the oil owners, the Koch brothers, David Koch, Charles Koch, they know that they're wrecking the planet. They absolutely know that. But they don't care. They're making money as long as they're there. And they don't think they'll be there later. They'll not be reborn as some sort of... I told them once at an energy industry conference in Norway. I said, they will be reborn downstream from a refinery as some kind of fish with skin and no scales, wriggling in toxic water, and like trying to lay an egg, and glowing green like Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson fish downstream. And you know, they're Norwegians and they all eat weird fish, so they're like, oh. They then applaud it. They applaud it. And they have done nothing since. Something, but not much. Okay, my point is, there's no time, so the liberty and opportunity means this. Also, how valuable is your life to you? That's another question. We're supposedly all very upstanding and this and that, but how much are you really valuing yourself? What is your worldview? What produced you? Are you a genetic product? In other words, you're a gene carrier. You're carrying a bunch of selfish genes around, and they're hopping around. There's one biologist who worked in Emory with a bunch of Tibetans in Dharamsala, a wonderful book he wrote called The Enlightened Gene. So he's just hoping, you know, he's trying, because the lamas are getting to him though, even though he thinks they're backward and whatever, but he's deployed about it. He's a very nice person, you know, the selfish gene. But the selfish gene is the usual model of the gene, right? Richard Dawkins. Is it very valuable to be the carrier of selfish genes from A to B and then your job is done? What is it, the materialist thing? 15 or 85 cents worth of cheap chemicals in a bag of water? That's what a human being is. These like communist countries where they would just kill off millions Stalin or Mao or somebody drinking like a lot of alcohol, numbing themselves, and then just giving orders and killing like millions of people. Because it's unfortunate, they die, but then once they're dead, they don't know they ever lived, so they're cool. No problem, and then there'll be no consequence to me, because I'll die and I'll never live. You know, this is that psychotic attitude of the people who are not committed, that they are part of nature and will remain. Their consciousness and sensitivity will remain a part of nature. And therefore, nature will has feedback loops, you know, and what they put out into it will come back to them. Okay? That's a really huge, huge difference. And if you shift into that worldview, and then you realize that you have a time, you have a platform. You know, you have a hard drive, software drive, you have software and a hard drive. So wetware, I call it actually. You have wetware and software to do something conscious about your condition and develop a consciousness that you can learn to lucidly dream. You can investigate your own unconscious. You can not be driven by blind impulse and reactivity as much. You can diminish it by practicing mindfulness, by practicing yoga, etc. You can do these things. And you don't know how many years you may have left, you know, because it can strike at any time. But whatever you have, you can make a big difference to your continuity by learning to more control your continuity, to master your mental process. And the subtlest processes in your being are the ones that will go on. You know, your bicep, if you lift weights or something, or you do something, that's not going to go on with you. But your subtle nervous system, and then maybe what works in the subtle nervous system, your consciousness, your concentration, your ability to restrain being driven by this or that reactive impulse, that will go with you. Then you have the opportunity to create that, intensify your creation of that. And that's immensely valuable to you. Why? Because all your future lives will be really grateful that you shaped up in this life. Because what happens through this life is determined by what you did in previous ones. And furthermore, if you then, you know, the Darwinian vision is a wonderful vision, actually. I used to like Carl Sagan in his Cosmos movie, you know, when he would do the walk in the cosmic calendar about the human being, you know, because if they have this, their scientific transposition of a new mythology of upfront Precambrian slime, you know, that one, Big Bang and the whole thing, and then it's their own version of Genesis that they have. And therefore it seems very plausible to people brought up in that kind of thing. And he used to walk on the cosmic month, you know, the calendar, and he would come to, like, human beings came out at like 5 minutes to midnight. Of course there's an end. And poor guy, the end is the end. You know? It relates to everything being at an end, you know. Which is not the case. There's no end. I have a book I call Infinite Life. Which I like, one of the few books I wrote that I like afterwards when I read it. And I'm forced to read it for some reason. And when I did it, my editor was hated the title, and they wanted to take it away from me. And then one of their arguments was, do you want to go around promising people infinite life? You don't really want to do that, do you? I says, no, I don't want to do that. I want to go around threatening them with it. Precisely. So once it's infinite, you have to book your reservations, your tent, your room, your massage in the next life. And your body, you have to create it. How are you going to create it? How did you create your body? How did you get this human body? Then you go into the biological thing. It's a bunch of genes, selfish genes that didn't do it. Selfish genes could never create a human being. It's too weird for selfish genes. Selfish genes would make it, they are little Pac-Man. Munching around, you know, eating bacteria or something. I don't know what they do. They gene their way along. And then they want a big machine that looks just like them, right around eating everything. You know, like a rhinoceros, you know, a dinosaur. They never quit being a dinosaur. Some outer space, they get rid of dinosaurs. They got bored with being dinosaurs. We did. We got bored with being a dinosaur. Really boring. Just think about dinosaur sex. Talk on a blackboard. Caress. The dinosaur caress. So we're this weird, soft, vulnerable, completely don't know what we're doing, completely deprogrammable, reprogrammable, brainwashable, and unbrainwashable entity. And that's our great virtue. And very vulnerable also, so we know it's serious, you know. We're soft skinned, you know. No armor plate.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa's annual Buddha and the Yogis program, held annually in the heart of the Catskills in Phoenicia, New York. As we heard in the first part of this week's podcast, Bob discussed the Lam Rim and the three principles of the path. And it was kind of sweet. He explained it from a very kind of non-Buddhist perspective. You see, this program brings together yogis from all over the country, students of Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor, and practitioners from all different traditions. Well, they come together each year and they have informal dialogues, daily practice, and, this teaching was one of those special moments where Bob was bringing together his years of knowledge and putting it forth in a really entertaining, fun way that's easy and accessible. I really enjoy the Buddha and the Yogi programs. Even though I'm not a yoga practitioner, I find the talks and all levels yoga refreshing and rejuvenating. To learn more about this annual program, be sure to visit menla.us. Special thanks this week goes to Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa. If you're inspired to learn more about the topic of Lam Rim, or about the teachings from the Buddha and the Yogis program, be sure to visit bobthurman.com or visit the podcast description. There's links that go to past podcasts on this topic and from this program. This free weekly podcast is brought to you in part with the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special Dasset tours of geographic expedition around the world with Robert Thurman and friends, please visit tibethouse.us. Tibet House membership also includes access to its member archives. These archives include teachings from Tibet House US in New York City and teachings from Menla in Phoenicia, New York. Full access begins at $2 a month. And if you can't donate, know your online participation is equally valuable to help Tibet House US fulfill its mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Be sure to like, subscribe, and follow on all your favorite social media platforms. And as always, weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyo. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit TenzinChogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and the second half of this week's podcast.
Think about that, and it takes time. You have to read literature about the former life stories of the Buddha. You have to see, you imagine the different animals and how a body can fit with an instinct, like an instinct of anger. You know, beauty, for example, comes to beings and they become mammals and things because they become more altruistic. They become more gentle. And beauty is the restraint of aggression. Beauty comes from the restraint of aggression. Ugliness comes from anger, from aggressive hostility. Therefore, predators tend to be ugly. I mean, we might say the tiger, burning bride, and all that, but Blake can write. But he wouldn't be writing that a tiger was chasing him around London. It would not look pleasant to him, that hungry tiger. Okay, So liberty and opportunity are hard to get. This is really critical. It makes you really value yourself and your body, where you're like a person who I can't have time to waste my time, because every minute of my life, as long as it lasts, I can do something in that to shape all the minutes for self and others extremely, with a limitless consequence. There's no end to the consequence of whatever little improvement I can make in any particular moment. Because this is so valuable, the opportunity that I have. It really changes the way you live these moments, is what I'm saying. And then there's no time. Then this involves meditating on death. So what happens here is that they say if we really appreciated our human embodiment, if we understood how it came to be, and what was our role in making it come to be, not just our parents' role, our species' role, genes' role, all these other things, material, environment's role, but our own role. How do we dream ourselves into this in life, in other words, into this life form that we have? I really appreciate that the effort that we've made and how valuable what we have created is as being us. And then we realize we'll lose it. And then we'll lose it in a way where what goes will not be the thing, the process that we normally focus on. Because we normally focus on exterior things. This deep inner thing, we don't usually make our major investment of time in the day, of effort in life, effort in the week. We don't usually do it. But we will, combining these two, and they say, and furthermore, he says, you will turn off your interest in this life. And that means that all our focus of how am I going to get through however many years I have to live, which in itself is living in denial that I could live no years. You just do death and impermanence without first challenging the materialist devaluation of our human lives. Immense devaluation that creates this tremendous depression in materialist minds. The real root of it is that psychosis. That I'm nothing, and it all amounts to nothing, and why am I bothering? When we figure that out, we are no longer only focused on whatever remaining period of time we think we might have in this life. But this is a foundation. And then next step is, contemplate the inexorability of illusionary effects and the sufferings of life over and over again, and you will turn off any kind of excessive interest in future life. The Buddhist worldview, what the Buddha calls realistic worldview, the first of the branches of the Eightfold Path of achieving freedom from suffering, achieving nirvana in Buddhist education system, is adjusting the worldview or belief system. And the one belief system that the only thing that one is asked to really deal with is causation. Which should be surprising, I think, because we're all thinking of Buddha as a religious founder, like Moses or Jesus or something. And then he can be seen that way by, as I said, those who are not really using the education system. Why is the Buddha celebrated as discovering causation? According to Tibetans, 2,900 years ago. According to Western modern people, 2,500, but nobody really knows for sure. But anyway, why? What is the big deal about causation? Or identity? And the word identity, idem means the same in Latin. The titi thing means, the iti thing is an abstract suffix. So identity means sameness, basically. It's the real you that's always been you and always will be, type of thing. And that's what, we're outside the flow of causation. So if we sort of accept that it's realistic to accept that everything is caused in the relative world, that everything is relative in the relative world, that everything is caused in the relative world, then that means we're adopting an attitude and a worldview that subtly, perhaps at first, erodes that feeling of being this independent, separate thing, which makes life so problematic. There's this thing there that it's just always me. So, except the deciding to be practical and deal with causality is the only sort of belief stricture, you can say. That's what constitutes realistic belief. Because once you really accept that in the relational world, which after all is the only world you know, right? You've never had any knowledge of anything that wasn't relational, have you? You can't, that knowing something is related to it, right? So everything that you know has always been relational. And so once you accept that that's the case, then suddenly you're in this vast plane where maybe the idea of an uncaused cause is just asinine. It's just a ridiculous thing that someone says to make themselves feel comfortable. Oh yeah, it only goes far back. I don't have to worry about anything further. And then there's some sort of ending has to be put there too. I don't have to deal with it for that long. So there's this compulsion to enclose yourself in time to a first beginning and a total ending. Which is just unrealistic. That's not realistic. Uncaused cause is nonsense. So when we do that, then we think that there are going to be effects of everything. Everything, every cause will have an effect. Every effect itself is a cause of something else. And then we realize that no matter how much effort we have made in this life, and then there's this second thing, and the sufferings of life means you reflect about the gods, you reflect about heaven, you reflect about the most pleasant thing you can possibly think of, your most ideal situation or circumstance, you could be in the best thing, the nicest thing, and still there would be suffering. You know, sort of the way you are to experience things. You know, you would see that. And then you would not so much, you would lower the priority. Return off your interest means you lower the priority. So it doesn't mean that you don't seek a better future life. To be born with a nice family and a nice planet and a nice, that isn't doing global warming, that isn't overpopulated, that isn't filled with torture and Holocaust and things. You might aspire to that perfectly rationally. But it would be not your highest priority because you would know that there would be no such thing that would be that. Complete freedom from suffering. And you're sort of beginning to suspect that there may be such a thing as complete freedom from suffering. When you then, by constant meditation, your mind will not entertain a moment's wish, even for successes of this life, and you will aim for freedom day and night, then you experience transcendent renunciation. So this is why, in Asia, under the immense power of the Buddha's realization and all of the institutions that came from it. India was transformed, and India was not India. India was many different nations, hundreds of them. And all the rest of Asia, and even came into Iran, came even to Iran, you know, Mani, the Manichaean Mani, he claimed to be the disciple of Zoroaster, Buddha, and Jesus, all three. So they all knew all about it, even in the West. You know, it went to the West, even though people in the West think everything happened in the West. Actually, it was influenced by the great culture of India, the wealthiest country, the California of ancient Eurasia, was India. So from this fact, so many people, when they realized this, they dropped out. Those economies were capable of supporting them. They tried to drop out in Europe too, but they got instantly executed or done in because they felt they couldn't support. And in China, they also didn't until around 800 years after India, they didn't have any monks or nuns. But people, when they realized that, they immediately don't want to have to be just feeding the body of this life, feeding the name of this life, feeding the property of this life. They didn't want to do it anymore. They didn't want to work on Maggie's farm. They wanted to develop themselves. They realized that the meaning of the human life is to evolve as a human being into an enlightened human being. And the human platform is the best platform to do it. And one after another, they just met Buddha. And they say it, I mean, I don't know if it really happened. I think it probably did, but if I saw it, I would faint. But many people who met Buddha, and they heard this sort of thing, they just said, oh, I take refuge in that. And he said, ehi bhikkhu, or ehi bhikkhuni. And their hair flew off, their clothes flew off, They got orange robes given by the gods, and they were like bhikshus. Just like that. They just said, Ehi bhikkhu. Come hither, bhikkhu. Bhikkhu, and bhikkhu doesn't mean monk or nun. And bhikshuni doesn't mean nun. It means mendicant. And mendicant means someone who's on lifelong MacArthur fellowship. Which means they just have a bowl and people come and fill it. And they are very modest in demand. They only ask for lunch. Only free lunch. The Protestant anathema. No dinner, no breakfast, just lunch. And because they only want to keep the body going, to use the platform to learn, to think critically, to meditate, to develop this inner being, this inner mind, you know? This, the coarse, subtle, and super subtle mind. Get through the unconscious and so on. So that's what it means. It doesn't mean that, you know, so that's you don't entertain, in other words, you don't make a top priority any kind of success of this life. And you aim for freedom day and night. That's what you realize. That's the base, that's the only worthwhile thing. That's the only real fun is freedom. Then it says, so then you experience transcendent renunciation. This, if you ever liked Castaneda, if any of you are old enough that you ever read that during those days, this is what Don Juan used to call the warrior's abandon. You're sort of not so attached to everything. You lower your priority of your attachments. And you really realize that what your main aim is freedom. And because it is achievable. It doesn't necessarily take many lifetimes. It doesn't necessarily take, you don't have to necessarily wake up to it at an early age, although you're lucky if you do. But, and you might be already advanced, but whatever you do, it can have an eternal fruition. And then that's all you want to do. When you have this realization, that's when you have transcendent renunciation. And actually, it took me 45, maybe 40 years to realize, you know, we think of renunciation as some sort of masochistic person, they don't want to have like a little something nice, and they don't care about what they wear, and they don't care how they look. They really like freak out, you know, must be like depressed or something. Not at all. The renunciant person is the person who actually has compassion for themselves. Finally, they found someone to have compassion for, namely themselves. Why? I mean, think about what you get all anxious about. What are the things you make you really... You get this news and you get really anxious about something. Well, maybe some of the state of some other person, of course, it could be. You know, maybe it's some job promotion or some financial loss or gain or, you know, whatever it might be, reputational thing. But then we really get wired up about it. You know, presses all our buttons. You know, but they, none of them are this essentially important. That's transcendent renunciation. And so we still would take care of somebody in trouble or something happening. It doesn't mean that. You're even better at it. It's like in poker. If you kind of detach from the spoils, or like they said in the Gita, you're detached from the reward, you can do the fight the battle better. You can bluff better. You're much cooler. Your opponent can't read your things. You're more effective, actually, in interactive things if you have dropped out in a certain way. You're not like deeply gripped by your obsessions. So transcendence without the spirit of enlightenment, that's how I translate what they call bodhicitta. They use the Sanskrit word. Chitta just means mind, or it can mean spirit. It can mean different levels of mind. It itself can be defined different ways. And bodhi means enlightenment, so I call it spirit of enlightenment. But you could say mind of enlightenment, will, but it's composed of a will to enlightenment, and it's composed to a sense of the presence of enlightenment, both. What's called the aspiring spirit of enlightenment and the present spirit of enlightenment, the functioning spirit of enlightenment. And so it cannot generate the supreme bliss, in other words. And here's where you begin to get this, what's called the Mahayana in Buddhism, the universal vehicle attitude, which in a way Now, in this thing about escape and transcendental renunciation, some people cannot imagine being perfectly blissful without any suffering, and yet still in relationalities, still dealing with Uncle Joe, with a bad president, with the, whatever it is, you know, or dealing with the, you know, Iraq, the Middle East, the insane world, the global warming. They can't imagine it. So they imagine a state of non-suffering as some kind of completely inconceivable thing apart from all relationalities. They think, therefore, that nirvana is apart from samsara. And the Buddha allowed them to do so. Although he told them, actually, no, about, he described states that are seeming states apart from causality, and he said those are not nirvana. So he kind of didn't quite give them a real crunchy satisfaction of, yeah, nirvana is like beyond that barrier, you know, beyond the sound barrier, beyond the space barrier, beyond whatever. He wouldn't quite let them do that, although he knew they would keep misunderstanding things that he said as to thinking that. But then his deeper one is where this is nirvana already. That's the deeper one. He, after all, attained it under the Bodhi tree. He said, I'm free of suffering. Hey, wow! Profound, peaceful, luminous, without any complication, and immortal. Like an elixir of immortality is this reality I have discovered, he said. And so some people realize, kind of, we are interconnected. Everything is interconnected. You see, the idea that you can catapult yourself out of the relative into the absolute is a kind of uncritical idea. Because the absolute means the opposite of the relative. Therefore, there's no point of relationship between the absolute and the relative. Do you follow? Just a simple meaning of the binary words. And therefore, there's no way of getting any place outside of the world is related to the world. So one of these things you hear, like, in monotheism or in theologies of Western and Eastern, you hear a lot of stuff like that. Oh, God is absolute hell. Oh, sure, God is not bothered about anything in the world. No way, bro. But then he creates it without relating to it. But that's just a dogmatic assertion, that sort of thing. It's not sensible, not meant to be sensible, realistic. So, point is that this, the spirit of enlightenment comes when one realizes, even ahead of time, about causality, one realizes that the causality thing means that relativity is kind of infinite. And once relativity is infinite, then there has to be some way of being in relationship without suffering, blissful, in all circumstances, logically speaking, unless there's no escape at all, and we just resign to just running around up and down in the cycle. So this guy at least thinks that there's a way of being blissful right here and now. And then they say later a lot of things like nirvana is, you can't find them, they can't tell nirvana and samsara apart. This is nirvana. That's kind of really strange idea, isn't it? Right? Anybody feel like they're in nirvana? I mean, me and Manlot's close, but not quite. So whatever we think nirvana is. So spirit of enlightenment, however, are those who, even though they're not yet really sure what nirvana is, maybe not even sure there is such a thing, they realize they are interconnected with everyone. So therefore, the only way of it being nirvana is if everybody gets nirvana. Right? Because even you're blissful, some other unblissful being there, like writhing in agony around you, that, you know, that's bad vibes, you know, that spoiled the whole thing. You don't actually feel everything that all the agony they're having, but the fact that they're having it bothers you, because your sensitivity and intelligence is like that, right? So that spirit of enlightenment means you decide, I'm not going to shoot for a self-isolated nirvana. I'm going to shoot for everybody's nirvana, but mine, very much mine too. So it's enlightened self-interest. My nirvana depends on everybody having nirvana, and their having nirvana depends on mine having. So I'm going to get mine for them. You follow? That's what the spirit of it. That's the bodhisattva attitude. Okay?
Thanks again for tuning in. And if you'd like to reach me, Justin Stone Diaz, I can be found on most social media platforms as Justin Stoned and at justin@menla.org. If you're inspired by what you hear here, please be sure to like, subscribe, follow, and post on your favorite social media platform. Your online participation helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Delek.